From NPR News, this is Weekend Edition. I'm Lynn Neary, sitting in for Leanne Hansen. Maya Angelou has lived many lives: poet, performer, political activist, and professor. She's also a mother, great-grandmother, and mentor. And now she is celebrating her 80th birthday. Born in St. Louis on April 4, 1928, her parents named her Marguerite Johnson. She decided to change that name when she started her life as a performer and began her transition to the artist she is today. A new biography of Maya Angelou has been published to coincide with her birthday, and Maya Angelou joins us now from her home in New York to talk about her life. Welcome and happy birthday.
And thank you very much for both.
Now, as I just mentioned, you changed your name to Maya Angelou when you began performing as a calypso singer in the 1950s. But I understand you had some inspiration in that from your own great-grandmother. Can you tell us that story? Your great-grandmother changed her name when she was freed from...
Oh, that's true. My great-grandmother was born a slave and lived as a slave until the end of slavery. And at that time, she changed her name to Kentucky Shannon. And when asked, even into the 20th century, why did she change her name to Kentucky Shannon? She said because she liked the sound of it. And we asked her, everybody asked her, if she had been enslaved in Kentucky. She wouldn't say. She didn't want to have anything to say about slavery. But my brother changed my name early on and changed me from Marguerite to Maya. Uh-huh. He first just called me my sister. And then he called me Maya. He read about the Mayan Indians. And so he named me Maya. And I married someone who had a name like Angelo. And that's it.
And that's how you changed your name?
Yes. It seemed to have been changed for me.
When you did change your name and began being called Maya Angelou, did that in any way sort of symbolize a kind of transition that was going on in your life as you were becoming an artist?
I suppose so. But, you know, an artist becomes and is made and has artistry thrust upon them. Everybody born comes from the Creator trailing wisps of glory. We come from the Creator with creativity. I think that each one of us is born with creativity.
But you first started sort of manifesting that creativity and the artist in you as a dancer and as a singer. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, well, I can sing somewhat. But I used to really be a dancer. And the only two things I ever loved was dancing and writing. But alas, before I was 25, my knees turned out to be not the best. So I had to stop dancing for a living. And I could sing somewhat. I'm not being coy. I have no coyness or modesty. So I was never a good singer because I never loved it. Hmm. Whatever you want to do, if you want to be great at it, you have to love it and be ready to make sacrifices for it. And I wasn't prepared to make sacrifices for singing. Hmm. But I will make sacrifices to write.
Yeah. But that period of your life where you were singing, and I think you were a calypso singer and dancer, and then...
Yes, I was known as Miss Calypso. And when I'd forget the lyric, I'd just tell the audience, I seem to have forgotten the lyric, I will now dance. And I would move around a bit.
How did you make the transition to writing? You said that you always loved writing.
Yes. I started writing when I was, maybe 8 or 9. I've always loved it. But from the time I was 7 and a half or there, until I was 13, I didn't speak. I was what was called a volunteer mute. But I read everything. And since I liked poetry, I thought, well, let me write it. I wrote some of the worst poetry west of probably the Mississippi River, but I wrote. And I finally sometimes got it right.
Of course, you really became famous with your memoir, your autobiography, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings.
Yes.
Came out in 1970, gigantic bestseller, nominated for the National Book Award. How did that book change your life?
Well, in a very interesting way, Miss Neary, I had thought when I started to write it that I would write one book and that would be it. I'd be able to include my life and my feelings, my philosophy, my discipline, etc. But it wasn't. I just got to 17. And so I thought, well, maybe I can do one more. And of course, the last book in the autobiographical series is Song Flung Up to Heaven. Six books.
Do you have another autobiography in you?
No, I don't. No, it's the end of it. Okay. I used a poem of Paul Laurence Dunbar for the title of the first book, and a poem of that same poem for the title of the last book. The poem is Sympathy. Mr. Dunbar wrote this in about 1894. And the poem says, I know what the caged bird feels. Ah, me. When the sun is bright on the upland slopes and the river floats like a sheet of glass and the bud on the branch still opes, I know what the caged bird feels. The last verse says, I know why the caged bird beats its wing till its blood is red on the cruel bars. It must fly back to its perch and cling when it fain would be on the bower swing. And a song comes from its deep throat. Upward to heaven, it is a prayer that upward to heaven it flings. So that those are the titles of those two, the bookends, the first and the last of the series.
As successful as your memoirs have been, as you said, poetry has always been your first love. Why is that? What is it about poetry that allows you to express something that you can't express in any other way?
Well, poetry is at once the use of the language and music, and it is music. Young people all over the world, you ask them to repeat some of the popular music of their day. In some cases here, hip-hop, rock and roll. People know those lyrics. Now why? They can't sing the melody quite often, but they remember the lyrics because it is poetry. And the spirituals when I was young, and just imagine a lyric which says, go down, Moses, way down in Egypt land. Tell old Pharaoh to let my people go. Our deep river, my home is over Jordan. I want to go home to Canaan land. Goodness gracious, if that's not poetry, then Shelley never wrote, and James Weldon Johnson didn't write Lift Every Voice and Sing.
Do you have a favorite poem of your own? Can you
Of my own? No, it would be the last poem I wrote. I don't have any favorites. Some things you use at certain times. You know, if you're lonely or you feel you've been done down, it's nice to have And Still I Rise. You can find a poem by Edna St. Vincent Millay, early 20th century white female poet. Thin, slim, about to become the recluse she did become. And this little woman wrote, I shall die, but that is all I will do for death. With his horse's hooves on my chest, I will not tell him where the black boy lies hidden in the swamp. I shall die, but that is all I will do for death. Brothers and sisters, the keys and the plans to this city are safe with me. It's nice to hear that.
It's beautiful. It's wonderful. I have to ask you about another part of your life, because there are so many parts of your life. Politics has run all through your life, you've been very involved in politics, really, since the 60s, I think. Mm-hmm. I know that you're a supporter of Hillary Clinton, but I wanted to ask you, even given that, you know, what does it mean to you that in your own lifetime you are seeing this election where both a woman and a black man have a real shot at the White House?
It's so exciting. And you know, I had someone ask me, but things haven't changed, have they? Please. Are you kidding? Things have changed. We have to admit that we've come a long way, so that young people would not be encouraged to say, you mean to say with the lives and deaths of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and the Kennedys and Mahatma Gandhi, you mean to tell me things are no better? Well, then what's the point of me trying?
Yeah.
Young people must be told, yes, things are better. Not nearly as good as they will be when you put your shoulder to the wheel.
You know, this book, which celebrates your life, is full of photos that show you surrounded by family and friends, and it's also full of recipes, and you really like to have fun.
Yes, I do. I work very hard, and I play very hard.
Yeah.
I'm grateful for life, and I live it. I believe life loves the liver of it. I live it, and I try to live it as a Christian. Trying to be a Christian means that I'm trying to take responsibility for the time I take up and the space I occupy. I am relieved to have a faith that there's no place that God is not. I have to know that. And my faith usually keeps me all right, but I lose it. And I say with the apostle and with the prophets, Father, I believe, forgive my disbelief.
Maya Angelou, a new biography, Maya Angelou, A Glorious Celebration, has just been published to coincide with her 80th birthday. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Here's a very short introduction to an equally short subject, mini-biographies. Author Michael Farquhar has a new book of them called A Treasury of Foolishly Forgotten Americans. These are people who, for some reason, official history has overlooked. Michael Farquhar joins me in the studio. Hi.
Thanks for having me, Andrea.
It's great
to see you.
Great to have you here. Now, I love that your book is 250 pages long and it has 30 biographies in it.
Yeah, and 30 is frustrating because there's thousands of these people that need to be rescued. But, you know, I had to limit it. I would love this to do well so I could write 10 more volumes. Because these are the second tier of American history, the overlooked, neglected notables. We always seem to ignore them in favor of the familiar icons.
Right. Well, okay, so let's start with one of them. Anne Bonny, Pirate of the Caribbean, a woman pirate.
Yeah, isn't that great?
Yeah.
I mean, nothing like a female pirate to pique my interest.
Who is this woman?
She was a little bit off-centered woman from South Carolina who met up with this pirate, Calico Jack Rackham. He recognized that certain savage something in her.
Even though she was from sort of the old South Carolina aristocracy.
Well, it appears she was, but she was also apparently a little unbalanced from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
Fit right in with this pirate crew. Women were obviously never allowed on pirate ships, but Rackham made an exception for his girlfriend. And together, the swashbuckling cutthroat crew terrorized the West Indies.
Now, I love this. They go around. She screams like a banshee, wields this giant, you know, broadsword. And they take over a ship. And among the crew on this ship they take over is a woman disguised as a man.
I know, exactly. So you end up with two female pirates on the same ship, Anne Bonny and Mary Read, which is great. What I liked about her was how touching she was when Calico Jack, her boyfriend, was tried and was about to be executed. And she came to see him. And she snarls at him, if you had fought like a man, you wouldn't be hung like a dog. A real touching farewell, worthy of a great pirate.
She was a tough broad.
She was a tough lady.
Now, these biographies are so great for the age of attention deficit disorder. I have to say, I just devoured three of them.
That's about my attention span as well. And when you got a few juicy anecdotes about mm-hmm. about these people who really did in so many ways contribute to the fabric of America, you don't need to, you know, start with their ancestors or anything like that. You know, I like to tell great stories. And I think this is 15 men, 15 women, great stories.
Michael Farquhar, I want to ask you about one more person. Guy Gabaldon, quote, the Pied Piper of Saipan. Now, this guy was 18 years old in World War II. He's from East Los Angeles, from a ghetto, a Chicano guy. and he single-handedly takes Japanese prisoners of war, hundreds of them, by himself. Tell me about Guy Gabaldon.
Actually, you know, people sometimes ask me who my favorite is, and it just might be Guy. Mm-hmm. This is the coolest kid I've ever stumbled across. You know, he was a lone Marine private. And what when he got to Saipan, what he did was he would go out on these lone missions, and he would go to various caves and convince the Japanese hiding in there that he had a whole force with him and that they better come out and surrender or that they would be roasted alive. You know, and they would creep out, and he would take them prisoner. It started with four or five, and then it was 50.
And the truth was, he didn't have anyone.
No, he was by himself. You know, really gutsy.
I love that the military didn't like him doing this at first.
At first.
But then he started bringing dozens of these guys, you know, these prisoners of war back, and they said, "Okay, man, go ahead."
Exactly. But the pinnacle, you know, is after the last Banzai attack on Saipan. Guy Gabaldon captures a few Japanese. What he does is he's able to speak a smattering of Japanese because he was adopted, semi-adopted by a Japanese family in Los Angeles. Mm. And so he kind of is talking with them, sharing cigarettes and making them a little bit at ease. And these are not people, by the way, who are easily put at ease.
These are suicide fighters.
Exactly. And in fact, a number of them were hurling themselves off the cliffs of Saipan rather than be captured.
Wow.
So at the end, he convinces one of these guys to go back into the cave and talk to their superiors. Mm-hmm. And he gets them to come out. And suddenly, hordes of Japanese are streaming out of these caves. 800 in all.
800. Hundreds of men streaming
out
of caves.
And he is completely by himself.
And he just alone walks them over to the American side of Saipan.
Exactly. 800, let's emphasize again. And remember Sergeant Alvin York in World War I, who got all those people to surrender and won a Medal of Honor.
Mm-hmm.
Guy got tons more than Alvin York ever did, and yet Alvin York gets the Medal of Honor, and Guy Gabaldon was still waiting for his when he died in 2006. But he's a true hero.
Michael Farquhar is the author of A Treasury of Foolishly Forgotten Americans, Pirates, Skinflints, Patriots, and Other Colorful Characters Stuck in the Footnotes of History. Michael Farquhar, thanks very much.
Thanks, Andrea. It was great. I enjoyed it.
So, as promised, it's time to announce the second pick of our recently formed Bryant Park Project Book Club.
Here's how it works. We pick a book. We give you a month to read it. We have a book club leader, Sarah Goodyear, who's over there.
Hello.
Periodically visit us on our blog, remind us to keep reading, gives us stuff to think about, and then we field your questions.
Then we get to interview the author, and we will pose those questions to him or her. And we just wrapped up A Month of Reading in the Country of Men. That was a book by Hisham Mater. And our next book is going to change things up a bit, Sarah, right?
That's right. It's something completely different. It's called The God of Animals by Aaron Kyle. It is set in the American West, where I think you're from.
Woo-hoo!
Rachel.
Yeah, she hails from Montana, right?
Well, actually, I think she grew up in Colorado, and now she lives in Missoula. This book is set in Colorado, and it's about a young girl growing up on a ranch. And so it's America. It's a woman. It's completely different from In the Country of Men.
And is it a little more uplifting? That was some of the comments on the blog. We're like, you know, this was a really good book by Hisham Mater, but can the next book be something that doesn't bum us out quite so
much? I don't want to give away any spoilers, but I can promise no public executions in
Excellent.
This book.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. But so the reason I read it is partly because of the way it starts out. So I'm just going to read a little bit from the beginning.
Do.
6 months before Polly Kane drowned in the canal, my sister Nona ran off and married a cowboy. My father said there was a time when he would have been able to stop her, and I wasn't sure if he meant a time in our lives when she would have listened to him, or a time in history when the Desert Valley Sheriff's Posse would have been allowed to chase after her with torches and drag her back to our house by her yellow hair. My father had been a member of the Sheriff's Posse since before I was born, and he said that the group was pretty much the same as the Masons, except without the virgin sacrifices.
Any
book that starts out with somebody running away to the rodeo with a cowboy,
I'm sold.
I want to know more.
I'm into it. I started reading it last night, and it hooked you from the beginning. I'm quite excited about this.
What's interesting about it is that although it is more uplifting, it's not completely uplifting, and it does have some things strangely in common with the book we just read, because there's a mother who's kind of dysfunctional and absent. There's a kid growing up and trying to find her moral compass, her way in the world. It's a coming-of-age story, it's, you know, an American coming of age story, and so it's cool.
Do we know anything about her, this young woman who's written this?
Well, this is her debut. She published the first chapter as a short story in the Atlantic Monthly. It won a National Magazine Award, and she just, I think, is somebody who's really writing from the heart, and it really comes through. It's just storytelling. It's very good storytelling, and she's somebody who has not lived this story. It's not autobiographical at all, but she obviously knows about horses and about the desert and about the kind of vibe out there, which is really interesting.
Well, I'm excited about it. Everyone, get your books, get your copies of The God of Animals by Aaron Kyle. It's out in paperback. There's also an audiobook. It's also on Kindle for those of you who read the last book on your Kindles. And you may be able to find it at your local library. And then we'll talk to you online. And Sarah Goodyear will be there, close personal friend of the BPP. And she writes about books for Time Out New York Magazine. She's also a novelist in her own right. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
And thanks for joining us for this edition of the Bryant Park Project. That's it for this hour of the show. Remember, though, we're always online at npr.org/Bryant Park. I'm Allison Stewart.
And I'm Rachel Martin. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Have yourself a good weekend.
It's Friday. Woohoo.
Get reading.
Anybody who's had small children has probably tripped over the baby gadgets and strollers and plastic toys that cover the floor. Pamela Paul was determined not to fill her house with baby junk until she had her baby.
I have baby gear coming out of every closet, and I really found myself overwhelmed with products.
In a new book, Parenting Inc., Paul describes how companies have convinced parents to pay so much for baby goods.
It used to be that prior to 2003, the cap, really, that stroller manufacturers felt that they could reasonably charge for a stroller was, you know, maximum $300. The executives from Bugaboo came in and realized, wait a minute, parents are spending that much on a pair of shoes, and that's all you're spending on the gear that you're going to put your most precious child in and keep them in for 3 or 4 years?
So let's sell them a $700 stroller.
Actually, that would be cheap, you know. There are $1,000 strollers on the market now.
What are some other upscale baby product pioneers?
Well, now you have modernist baby nursery furniture. You have cribs that retail for over $3,000. Bouncy seats that traditionally are kind of garish looking. You know, they're bright primary colors. And parents decided that, you know, they wanted something more streamlined that would go with their aesthetic. And so a huge number of companies jumped in and created these beautiful brown and baby blue modern looking bouncers. And these aren't necessarily what children prefer.
Have you actually changed your behavior as a result of researching this?
Well, a little bit. I can't say that I've stopped shopping, and I wouldn't want to stop shopping. You know, I'm not saying that all shopping for your kid is bad and evil. There are a lot of great things out there. I mean, where would we be without the sippy cup? You know, can you imagine? Can you imagine? I mean, let's think about it. Your child's in the car seat and you're going to like have to lean back and give them a little cup to sip, and it's going to, you know, splash everywhere. At the same time, I have become a bit more restrained.
Okay, short of actually going broke, what is something that parents can do to restrain themselves?
You know, well, I think it's important to think about, well, what is this product promising me? And is this something that it can deliver? And is it even something I want to have delivered? So, for example, a lot of products and services you'll see will say, you know, this will eliminate frustration. Well, part of being an adult and even being a child is learning to cope with frustration. So if you eliminate frustration, how does the baby then learn to deal with it?
Oh, let's forget the frustration. I don't want the baby to cry.
Right. Well, you know, it's funny. One of my favorite products is called the Time's Up, Time's Out Teddy Bear. And this is this little bear that has like a little stop clock on it. And so when your child's in time out, you tick on this little teddy bear so that, you know, instead of screaming in frustration, they'll have a nice little teddy bear to hug and cuddle and let them know that time's out is all finished. But when you think about it, that's absurd. Time out is supposed to be awful. It's not supposed to be fun.
What about hiring people, in effect, to help you parent? We're not talking about nannies here?
No, this is beyond nannies. This is people to help train your child to sleep, to potty train your child, to stop them from thumb sucking. And I went into the research for my book thinking, you know, what a crock. And actually, I did a 180 on that because I spoke to a lot of these experts. And, you know, they're not making a mint off of parents. You can hire someone for a few $100 to help your baby sleep during the first few months. And that has a serious positive impact on the entire family, not just for a couple of weeks that a toy might amuse a child for, but for months. That can seriously make things better. And so I think it actually makes more sense to spend money on a sleep consultant than it does to spend money on a fancy crib.
Pamela Paul is the author of Parenting Inc. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Back now with Day to Day. We get a lot of letters here at the program, and a fair amount of them, well, they take us to task for our grammar. Here are a few mistakes that I made on the air that astute listeners caught. I said luxury instead of luxury, no G there. I also pretentiously and wrongly said homage rather than homage or homage. June Casagrande also gets a lot of letters. She writes a weekly grammar column that appears in newspapers here in Los Angeles, and she's collected some of her favorite language lapses in a new book. It's called Mortal Syntax. And June Casagrande is here now. Welcome to the studios.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, you know, there are no shortage of grammar books out there. So
indeed,
why pile on?
What I hope to do is help readers navigate that big pile. I don't want to add my voice to one of the many self-appointed experts on the subject. I want to help people navigate the world of experts who all disagree.
The first part of your book, though, you have biggies, and it says the biggies.
The biggies.
So there are some mistakes that, well, there are clear-cut answers to, right?
There are. The criteria for whether something is wrong or right isn't whether your mother's grandmother's English teacher wrapped around the knuckles for saying it. It is whether it is grammatical, according to the rules of English grammar, whether it is consistent with idiom, or whether the dictionary allows it. Those are the sort of three things that tell us right and wrong. In between, things like someone will tell you that you can't begin a sentence with the word hopefully. That's something someone was told that's no longer true and isn't necessarily true, and there's no book of rules saying you can't do that.
Hopefully you can just get away with that.
You can indeed, according to Webster's New World College Dictionary, yes.
Thankfully. Yes. Okay, yeah. Let's go through some of these that you have in the first section of the book. And one of them, happily for me, was one of my pet peeves, and that is saying so fun, as in that restaurant is so fun.
People will correct that and say it should be so much fun. And traditionally, that's correct. So fun, it's a question of whether or not fun is both a noun and an adjective or just a noun. So if that was so much fun, treats it as a noun. That was so fun, treats it as an adjective. And authorities disagree on whether or not you can. Therefore, some say you can. Therefore, you can.
Oh, no, I'm confused again. So I can say that restaurant was so fun?
I don't recommend it because it raises the hair on the back of a lot of people's necks, but it doesn't mean it's wrong.
Okay. What are some of the mistakes that we make all the time that are just wrong?
There's kind of a little catch-22 in what you said, which is if we make them all the time, they cease to be wrong. The rule books and the style guides and the dictionaries are all based on usage. And so if you and I use something wrongly often enough, it becomes sanctioned. So, but some examples of things that are still frowned upon by the most respected authorities include stuff like the word enormity, to mean enormousness, to refer to size. Mm-hmm. Enormity actually refers to great evil for the most part. It refers specifically to something negative, and they don't like to hear it used to mean enormousness. A lot of stuff like that.
Okay, what about, this is a common mistake that people make all the time, lay and lie.
There is not so much gray area on this one. The style experts all say, let's respect this distinction. Lie is an intransitive verb. It does not require an object. Lay is a transitive verb. It requires an object. So it's very easy. I lie down. I lie on the bed, but you lay something else on the bed. You lay the book on the bed. Very simple, until you take note of the fact that the past tense of lie happens to be lay. That's where people just sort of cash it in and give up, and it's hard to blame them. But today I lie on the bed. Yesterday I lay on the bed.
Right. Okay. Got it. All right. So what about I feel good versus I feel well?
Well is the word traditionally used to describe a state of good health. However, if you open Webster's New World College Dictionary, the very last definition of good is in good health. So technically, if you want to get technical, you can say, I feel good.
People say that all the time. How are you? I'm good.
They do. And that's defensible as a casualism, as some experts would call it. If you're minding your P's and Q's, stick with well, because that's traditionally more accepted.
Is there something that even though is commonly used, you just can't get your head around and you just can't abide?
Things that make me cringe personally. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not a big fan of the pronunciation nuclear. Don't like that. There are a number of things that make me cringe a little, but I think I'm a cringer by nature. I think I'm one of those people who deep down wants to be persnickety and kind of mean about it. And that's kind of no way to live because if you spend too much time focusing on other people's errors, number one, you'll find yourself wrong a lot. Number two, you'll find yourself pretty miserable.
Okay, listen up, listeners who are poised with pen in hand. All right. One thing, though, I feel very persnickety about, and that is the increasing use of nouns for verbs and vice versa.
Beer me? Like that?
Exactly. Or something like, how does that impact you?
I haven't checked that one lately, but I think that usage has become officially sanctioned by at least some dictionaries.
That kills me.
Yeah. I like beer me, though.
So something that seems to be right, but grammarians would probably shudder, is ending sentences with prepositions.
There's no such rule that says you can't do it. It's a very popular myth that there is a rule. An example is, who are you going to the movies with? Mm-hmm. With is a preposition. There it is hanging at the end of a sentence. There is no rule against that. However, it's a little awkward at times, and it's somewhat of a violation of what a preposition's supposed to do, which is they always take objects. So I'm going with her. Her is the object of that preposition. When you put it at the end of a sentence, it sort of causes it to break ranks from standard preposition form because it no longer has its object there right after it.
So what would you say?
I would put the preposition at the end of the sentence. A lot of people think grammar is a list of prohibitions. It's just uptight, mean-spirited, no, you can't. And what I try to dispel is that image of grammar, because what it really is a fascinating study of how we assemble words to create meaning. The English language is such a fun toy that we can play with, and if we take that spirit toward it, it just makes it fun and useful and a very effective tool.
Well, June Casagrande, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
June Casagrande, she's the author of the new book, Mortal Syntax, 101 Language Choices That Will Get You Clobbered by the Grammar Snobs, Even If You're Right. All right, and before you fire off that email, I am going to correct myself. At the beginning of this very interview, I said, there are no shortage of grammar books. How could I have done that?
Well, look, you know.
Nobody's perfect, I guess.
There is no shortage.
There is no shortage.
Day to Day is a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Alex Chadwick.
And I'm Madeline Brand.
So the Bryant Park Project's book club spent a month of March, the month of March, reading Hisham Mater's novel In the Country of Men. And today the book club is holding an online meeting. Here to tell us how you can join in is our dear friend. She has been away. We are so glad that she has returned to us after many days
Laura
of being
Conaway.
Gone. Laura Conaway.
Good morning. How are you guys?
We're doing great. Also with her today, book club hostess Sarah Goodyear. Hey, Sarah.
Hello, Rachel. Hello, Allison.
Thanks
How
to
are
both
you?
Of you.
Good.
So what's going on? We apparently opened a thread on the blog for comments and questions.
That's right. We just opened a thread, and the idea is that if you've read the book, even if you haven't finished the book, jump on there. You might have some plot points revealed if you haven't finished it.
Okay.
Jump on there. Say what you want to say. I've already been talking to readers who have read the book and have talked about how it's such a great way to go into a very difficult subject matter, Libya, the rule of Muammar Gaddafi, but seen through a perspective that really lets us into something that we might not know about otherwise. Christine Livernash of Wisconsin Falls, Wisconsin, said what she thought about it.
It's through the eyes of a child and what he saw and how he interpreted things, and it just was really disturbing to me. This book was hard for some people to read, and I think it's because we're always looking for happy endings and for things to turn out right, and realistically, this was a terrible, traumatic experience, and he didn't come out okay in some ways.
So this book club thing is new for us, and we are feeling our way through it. But we want people to just jump on there and start talking about what they think. And
I want to know what moment of the book shocked people, because I had three or four.
Yeah, there is a couple of really, really disturbing moments
and
in there.
Surprising things he does, or surprising things you find out about this family. Or
yeah, and what's really amazing is this child is able to just betray people and himself. And it's all a result of the environment that he's growing up in. And that's really powerfully done.
So we're gonna take what we get from people and use it. I think you guys are planning to talk to the author later this week.
Tomorrow. The author now lives in London, I believe.
That's right.
And we're going to do an interview with him. And we would love to know what your questions are for Hisham Attar.
Such an amazing
opportunity to think that, you know, you're actually going to get to ask questions of the person who your book club is written by.
That's
really
right.
Cool.
I mean, a lot of the time in a book club, you're just sitting around bouncing it around between yourselves. This time, Hisham Attar is going to be available to answer your questions, your concerns. You can find out how the book relates to his life. And it all happens here on the BPP Book Club.
Do we know anything else about what he's written? Is this something that's been typical of his work?
No, this is his first book. This is his first book, and I believe he is writing another book.
Yeah.
He has also written some essays. One of them is on our blog, an essay about his life and his father and his imprisonment in Libya. He's still missing. He's still gone.
And for those of you who can't join us for the blog and are concerned you might not hear the interview, we're actually going to tape the interview so we can play it on Thursday. So everybody will get to hear the interview.
Yeah, and that open thread will just be open for any time, no matter what time zone you are. We had a reader in Barcelona, I think, who was concerned that she wasn't going to be able to participate. But thanks to the miracle of the interwebs, we can all participate.
It was an excellent choice, Sarah Goodyear. And then I guess we get to announce the next book. When do you think? Tricia, Friday? Yeah. All right. Friday. Executive decision made right there. Live in the air. Love that. The Bryant Park Project Book Club discussion happening all day today on our blog. Go to npr.org/Bryant Park and weigh in on Hisham Attar's In the Country of Men.
Thank you, too.
To see both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back, Laura.
Thank you.
And that does it for this hour of the Bryant Park Project. We are always online, though. We don't go away. npr.org/Bryant Park. I'm Rachel Martin.
I'm Allison Stewart. We're 6 months old.
Yay!
Yay!
Happy birthday, everyone!
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.